This is a recording from the 2013 London and South East Day Conference held at Johnson House, London. Here, Dr. Christine Scott, Portfolio GP and teacher at Imperial College School of Medicine, shares from her personal experience of adversity to present a down-to-earth and pragmatic but faith-filled model of success.
Now, I don't know about you, but I read the obituaries in the BMJ.
See who you recognise.
Absolutely. And I enjoy Last Words on Radio 4. Anybody a follower of Last Words? It's a fascinating obituary programme which is about the dead, who have just, you know, the amazing movers and shakers in the wider world. And it's, I find it inspiring and fascinating and humbling and challenging to hear the achievements of our colleagues and the movers and shakers in the wider world. Now, interestingly, my 15-year-old son is a little bit addicted to Radio 4 as well. He's a little bit of an unusual 15-year-old. And he likes Last Words too. And we recently had a very interesting conversation about who decides whether somebody merits inclusion in the programme. And why is it that we wait until death to celebrate what has been achieved? And why, he says, is it only nice and good things that are including? And we miss out everything that went wrong. You see, I really hope that when I grow up, I'm going to do something big. Now, that's me speaking now, not Tom, my 15-year-old. Because I want to make an impact for God. I really do, when I grow up. And who knows what it will be? Perhaps it'll be a cutting-edge piece of research that improves the outcome of depression in my patients. Mental health is very much a thing that I'm interested in. Perhaps I'll develop an innovative service to bring real care to those in most need. I'll revolutionise teaching by encouraging medical schools to pay real attention to spiritual needs. Who knows what might be in my last words? You see, I am planning a career that really builds on my natural skills and fulfills my potential to do good and really glorifies God. But now I better really introduce myself. But who I really am is Christine Scott. I'm GP, I'm a locum, I'm an appraiser, a bit of sessional teaching at Imperial Medical College. So I must be something. In short, I'm a portfolio GP and I'm 56 years old and still waiting to grow up. And I've been a GP since 1986, when in the northeast of England, GP jobs were very hard to come by because in the northeast of England, people get it right and they knew how important general practice was. And so it was a high profile thing to do. So when I was offered a part-time partnership, I took it. And actually, out of the 12 people finishing my vocational training scheme, I was one of only two to have a post at the end of it. So, you know, I was pretty pleased by my part-time partnership, but actually I didn't want to work part-time. And so began this portfolio career. And I'm really quite proud, though a little bit disappointed, that I was in fact a portfolio GP before they'd invented the term, and I wish I'd thought about it first, because I could have written something in the BMJ about it, and then I could have been recognised as being as successful in importance as I clearly want to be. But that didn't happen either. But because I've been a portfolio GP, i.e. I've been underemployed for quite a bit of my career. No, I've been a portfolio GP. I've had time to do some really interesting things. One of the things that I did after spending some time in palliative medicine was train as a cognitive therapist. And then I tinkered around a little bit in research. And then I came down to London and set up a Health Authority-wide suicide audit. Can anybody remember health authorities? Anyway, there was one and I did a job for them. And more recently, I've re-engaged in teaching undergraduates. But actually, my portfolio often feels like I'm jack of all trades and master of none. And much of what I've done has just happened and then kind of fizzled out and not really gone anywhere. Much of what has entered the portfolio and much of what has left has seemingly been a result of circumstances, accidental guidance, pragmatic decision making, albeit, to be fair, on the whole, surrounded by a considerable amount of prayerful thought. A move to London from Newcastle was necessitated by marrying a man with an immovable career. And so I left an established general practice and the research that I was involved in, and after quite a short time became a mom somewhat late on in life and moved on to the retainer scheme and ended my time as a partner in general practice. So little bits of pragmatic decision making, what I would call low grade guidance, but no great vision or overarching plan, and a little bit of discomfort as I see this fact that we should have a vision and know about this grand canvas on which we might want to paint. So how do I judge this? How does God evaluate all this melee of activity? Is it triumph, success, failure, disaster? Now, as a family, we're great fans of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I don't know how many of you know the quintessential phase after the original trilogy, when Arthur Dent ends up on a planet called Hawali. No? Anybody remember Hawali? Hawali is a strange planet populated by prophets and sages, and he goes there to look for guidance. And one of the people from whom he seeks guidance is an old woman, a smelly old woman. And she goes into her cave, pulls out a photocopier, which is solar powered, so it has to be pulled out of the cave, to print out her life story. And Arthur is somewhat bemused by this, as he is with much of what happens in the entire Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, if you remember. And he asks her why on earth she's printing out her life story, her testimony. And she says to him, "I've highlighted all the decisions I ever made." And he says, "Why have you done that?" He says, "Because if you do exactly the opposite from what I have done, you'd probably be a success." Now, I want to guard against my testimony being like the old ladies on Hawali. But you know, it's been really useful looking back and thinking through this portfolio career. And it's made me think again and focus on what I have done and what I guess we all do. So often we focus on what we do and we are defined by who we feel we are seen to be. How does the world view me? Who am I? And am I actually like the person that appears to be standing up here talking? Is that what I'm really like underneath? Is this a front? Is this what I want people to see? Lots of events have brought me back again recently to what is in this portfolio. And I think it's a spiritual portfolio. Our career portfolio really is a spiritual issue. What it is that I do and I am and I will present to my Lord to account for when he asks me what I've done with the talents he's given me is a spiritual issue, and it's part of the portfolio of what I do and who I am. And I'm sure that many of you will share my experience of learning spiritual lessons as a continuing process, but also sometimes that nagging feeling that the spiritual process is revisiting exactly the same ground time and time again. It's a little bit like my learning of the course of the cranial nerves. It makes entire and perfect sense at the time and yet comes as a complete revelation when I look at it again. Preparing this testimony has helped me look again at my portfolio and relearn some of what God's been teaching me about success and failure over the past few years. Just over 5 years ago, life took a rather unexpected turn for me with my diagnosis of primary breast cancer. At that stage, our boys were 8 and 9, and I was working as a part-time sessional GP and just beginning to get to that stage of family life when I thought that I could take a bigger share in clinical work and develop my career and that perhaps I was about to grow up. I was on my own when I went for the biopsy result because I was entirely certain that this socking great lump was nothing to worry about and that in usual ostrich fashion, everybody was making a great deal of fuss about nothing. And as the surgeon delivered the diagnosis to me, two friends who had breast cancer immediately came to my mind. One, a Christian, reacted with supreme poise, great faith, and was a wonderful testimony. And I remember very clearly at that moment a choice this morning, I forgot his name, I'm having a moment, Roland said, you know, hearing that voice as if it was a voice, but actually there not being a voice, but hearing that clear voice, you need to choose. And I remember being asked to choose how to do cancer. And I remember in that split second saying to God, praying perhaps that I would do my very best to do cancer God's way. That sounds very grand and terribly spiritual, and it really wasn't, because actually the next thing that happened was a very, very rude expletive came out of my mouth in response to the surgeon's diagnosis. And both these things were happening at the same time. So I'm really not that spiritual. But I really did know that I needed to do cancer God's way. Now, as Christians, we hear wonderful testimonies of how people, how God uses people in difficult circumstances. And actually, as soon as you have a diagnosis or you're in a difficult situation, and many of you will share some of these experiences, they're not, you know, unusual. You know, there's a real subtle pressure to be triumphant and to be a glowing testimony to the Lord. To proclaim triumph when actually it feels like disaster. And initially I applied my usual stringent criteria to this new entry to my portfolio and attempted really to do just this triumphal bit, but it didn't last very long, particularly since I ended up taking sick leave because it was the only way the practice was going to get reimbursement for a locum, partly, and also because my white blood cell count was a little bit too low to be managing people with meningitis. In fact, it wasn't measurable quite a lot of the time, which wasn't very helpful. And also, what was it like? Well, do you know what? I was relatively well and incredibly bored. So what did doing cancer God's way look like, if that is what I did? Well, in fact, it was very unremarkable and mundane. But having space helped me to reflect on what was important. I slowed down, and I didn't want to have a choice really because I wasn't much to do. I had coffee with friends that I hadn't met for ages. I wrote letters and received wonderful responses. I thought an awful lot. And I met some amazing people, professionals and patients, just folk I bumped into who noticed missing eyebrows and responded with amazing compassion. I baked cakes, made quite a lot of jam for some reason. And I had time to really listen to what people were saying to me and then gently express and receive God's love. And I was frequently bored, bad-tempered and impatient. But I remember a particularly frustrating two-hour waiting for phlebotomy being transformed by sitting next to an elderly lady from our church and being able to talk to her and encourage her. On another occasion, a hospital visit saw me bumping into a member of our congregation who was in an amazing state, having just been admitted with chest pain, and a quiet moment to just pray for him changed his day and mine. Without the focus of my work that did, and actually, if I'm honest, still does so much define me if I'm not careful, I looked differently at my everyday encounters. And God used so many ways to challenge my thinking and show me love. One particular example that strikes me was just before I started my chemotherapy. I was holding the door open for a fellow patient who I didn't know and haven't met since. And I made an empathic comment about the patient information leaflet she was holding in her hand. I was aiming to offer her compassion. And in response, she asked me about the stage of treatment I was at. She was a bit further on. And her response and advice about how to manage and cope with chemotherapy was amazingly pivotal in helping me see it in a positive light. It was a simple psychological trick that I can share with you later if you're interested, but what it was isn't important. But it gave me a real help over a hurdle. Just one of those God incidences. And it's one that I've passed on to many, many patients facing chemo since with really positive feedback. So during my treatment, I remember wondering whether I would be as confident in God if my prognosis was less favourable, because I was in quite a good group. I was so positive and able to enjoy the everyday in a deeper way just because, was it just because I was statistically in that favourable prognostic group? At the time, I was reading a book by our former vicar, Andrew Watson, who's now Bishop of Aston, called The Fourfold Leadership of Jesus. And in a chapter on Jesus' trust in the Father, Andrew tells the story of a member of our congregation and her battle with leukemia and her subsequent death. Throughout this, she was open and honest and full of humour about her journey. And I'd like you to read I'd like to read a little bit of what Andrew writes about in this passage, if I may. This is the second implication of this. Is that if preparation at the beginning of the lap is crucial, equally crucial is the handover at its end. No longer should my achievements, or indeed my failings, be seen in isolation from generations yet to come. No longer should my legacy be seen purely in terms of what I managed to fit into 40 or 70 or the 100 years allotted to me. Instead, my job is to complete my stint as faithfully and fruitfully as I can, while seeking to ensure a smooth and effective passing of the baton to my spiritual successors. This is a principle that I've seen lived out on many occasions, most recently in the death of Penny Phillips, an extrovert drama teacher in our church. And Penny was a friend of mine too. This followed a courageous 3-year fight with leukemia. My funeral sermon, Andrew writes, on that occasion largely wrote itself. For the most part, I simply read emails in which Penny charted the highs and lows of her illness and her faith with an honesty and a humour that were refreshing and deeply inspiring. And as I looked across the church to her husband, to her 3 sons, all involved in Christian ministry, and to the generations of Penny's students packing the building, I was struck afresh by the image of the baton, the spiritual legacy that Penny had passed on so fruitfully and effectively. For what is our hope, our joy or crown in which we will glory in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ when he comes? Is it not you, wrote Paul to the Thessalonians Christians. The essence of all this is the little word trust. We need to trust in the love and faithfulness of God, especially in the many times of testing, and trust that, despite all evidence to the contrary, God is working his purposes out as year succeeds to year. Without such trust, we all too easily lose hope. I clearly remember sitting on the 33 bus, which runs from my house to Hammersmith and Charing Cross Hospital, after another visit to radiotherapy, reading that very chapter, those very words, remembering Penny and questioning the nature of trust. And it was at that moment that that question that I raised earlier came to my mind. Do I trust God enough? Is it actually just too easy to trust because my prognosis isn't too bad, so I can be faithful and positive because of that? Would I trust if circumstances were different? I did a lot of thinking and praying on those return journeys on the 33 bus in November 2008. God's response to my question about trust was strikingly clear, audible, and immediate, just outside Barnes Station as we were turning right onto the Lower Richmond Road. And it went something like this. It isn't about the degree of difficulty you face. It is not about how easy you find it is to believe. And it is not about how much trust you have. Instead, what matters is that I am completely trustworthy in all circumstances. That message, that it didn't matter how much I trusted, but it mattered in whom I trusted, was what really came through. But that's 5 years ago, and testimonies clearly have to be up to date. So back to work, I carried on as a salaried GP part-time, started some undergraduate teaching, which I adore, and Ros is here and knows how much I enjoy it, and I slipped back into wondering what God would do with me when I grew up. The immediacy of God's care for me seemed to slip away slowly, and the marvel and delight that I had for the mundane everyday gifts and opportunities dimmed. And then 18 months ago, my husband was offered a wonderful job in Paris, and yet again, my haphazard portfolio was to be challenged with reconstruction. We decided as a family that the boys and I would need to stay in London, at least for the moment, but spend holidays in Paris. which meant me leaving a salaried post that I'd been in for 12 years, because 18 weeks school holiday a year didn't seem to go down too well with the partners. Anyway, so now here I am a locum with no practice base and still wondering about career progression. And I found it really, really difficult to adapt, to be honest. But the lesson that I'm relearning is that the mundane, the everyday, the washing shirts, the listening to my boys' stories when they arrive home, watching their videos of me doing the coolest jump you've ever seen on a bike, interacting compassionately with strangers, making cakes, but I haven't restarted the charm, and the like has every right to its place in my portfolio career. Our Paris home group in Versailles at half term was using some material by Mark Green about faith in work. And yet again, that message came clearly through that I need to learn and relearn, and I'm probably not wrong in thinking that many of us need to learn and relearn, is that our front line is actually wherever we are. This week's London home group, great having two churches and two home groups, looked at James and John's request to sit at Jesus' side in Mark 10. They wanted to be afforded those places of honour beside Jesus. The other disciples were really indignant. And Jesus brings them together and reminds them in Mark 10, verses 43 to 45, that whoever wants to become great amongst you must be the servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man didn't come to serve, but to be served. To be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Writing out my recent testimony has really been strengthening as I look ahead. You see, my portfolio is fine, and pragmatic guidance is actually okay. And the everyday and the mundane are wonderfully valuable and the stuff of life. How I am in small things actually really matters, and being willing to serve is just as important as what that service is. And more importantly, God is trustworthy in all circumstances. And I think it's probably about time that I stopped worrying about what I'm going to achieve when I grow up. Finally, having finished writing this and struggling whether I could actually read it, John Martin's email update from CMF arrived. And I'm sure you've all read it in every detail. He finishes this update that arrived 2 days ago with this verse from Deuteronomy. The Lord himself goes before you and will be with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. So don't be afraid and do not be discouraged.